I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hi, Jordan. And our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
So this week, we're continuing our countdown of the top 10 greatest movies from Total Film's lifetime, as voted for by Total Film staff and contributors from 1997 until now. So if you need to catch up on what made the grade from 10 till 6, please check out last week's episode first. We'll wait while you do that. And welcome back. And so now we're just going to have a little chat about what's coming out this week. And the biggest release probably is this.
Johanna Morrigan is dead. This is the legendary Dolly Wilde.
Last night, rock and roll meant nothing to me. By midnight, it was the most important thing in the world.
Darling, have you ever done an interview before?
I've never done anything before. These are the places you come where you can dance and scream and be with your own kind, where everything is possible.
This is Dolly Wilde. She's trouble.
Yes, I am trouble.
The thing about crossing over to the dark side is that once you're there, it doesn't feel dark at all.
Okay, so that's How to Build a Girl, which is an adaptation of Caitlin Moran's semi-autobiographical book about a young girl from Wolverhampton called Johanna, who wants to be a music journalist, and she's from a small town. She's not very confident in herself. How is she going to be one of these music critics that she looks up to? And she develops this idea of personality called Dolly Wilde, who writes terrible reviews of bands, and it's snapped up, and she sort of has this sort of fighting of her two egos, basically the teenager that she is and the woman she's growing into, and this Dolly Wilde person who is horrible. And how do those two sides of herself come together, and who wins? It's funny, it's comedy, it stars Paddy Considine as her dad and a whole host of famous cameos.
I haven't seen this film, Jane.
I haven't seen it either.
But all I really want to know is, does Beanie Feldstein have a convincing Wolverhampton accent?
I think she gets full top marks for trying, and probably 80% of the time it's fine. You can hear that she isn't from there. And she really, you know, put the time in before she started filming. She worked with a voice coach, and then she basically went and worked in a shop in Wolverhampton and kept in character and kept the accent the whole time. So she really puts the work in. The thing is with Beanie, we know from Booksmart, she's just this hugely likeable person. You really want the best for her and you give her the benefit of the doubt. And I think that sort of carries over to the accent where you're like, it's not quite there, but I'm going to go with it because I just really engage with this person.
Is it better than Josh Hartnett in the hairdressing comedy? I don't know if you remember.
Oh, God. When he's doing a Yorkshire accent, I'd forgotten that.
Or Anne Hathaway in One Day.
Yeah, it's better than that, so that's good.
Oh, well, there you go. I mean,
yeah.
It's a low bar to clear.
She starts wearing Doc Martens, she dyes her hair, she wears this ridiculous top hat and tails and, you know, fishnet tights, and she develops this whole personality and goes down to that there London and it lives this life that she thinks she always wants. And it, you know, because it's Moran, of course it delves into what it means to be a woman in that industry and how female writers are treated and how you find the North Star in yourself within that situation when it seems like everything's going right, but you're actually losing yourself in that situation. It's really heartwarming and sweet and funny, but it's not anything you haven't seen before.
Is the journalism convincing? Is it a convincing portrayal of journalism?
How long does she spend transcribing?
She doesn't do any transcribing.
Any copying voices.
Yeah, or doing her research and writing copious notes and writing a questions
Wikipedia
list. She's not doing any of that, so it's not like Total Film. But, you know, it's the 90s, so it's very much that sort of era and the music of that era. And the office she goes to is just this tip of an office in Soho somewhere, which, you know, I did work experience at just 17 and that's what it was like. So I think they've kind of got it right. Like I said, with Beanie, you just want the best for her. So you just really hope that she does find her way out of this and finds the happy medium between writing truthfully and being happy with herself as well.
So this is debuting on streaming on Amazon Prime. Did you feel like you were missing out watching it at home rather than in a cinema, or does it feel suited to home consumption?
It's fine for home consumption. It's just that lovely, you know, put your tea on your knee and watch that. It's a perfect film for that. It's a shame it didn't get a cinematic release because we do need stories like this in the cinemas that are mainstream, fairly big budget stories about young women. And it would have been nice for that to be available. But I'm sure it'll do very well on streaming. Right then, shall we move on from what's available now to our top 10 continued? So here's a recap of where we were last week. At number 10, we had Fight Club. At 9, Under the Skin. At 8, Memento. At 7, La La Land. And at number 6, The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. So shall we now discover what topped that lot in our poll of writers? Here's our number 5.
Where do we begin?
A year ago, these cops and lawyers wouldn't dare cross any of you. I mean, what happened?
So what are you proposing?
It's simple. Kill the Batman.
This is The Dark Knight, another Nolan film on the list. Jordan, what's going on here? Who's The Dark Knight?
Who is he? I've never heard of him.
Who is The Dark Knight?
If you somehow don't know, this is Christopher Nolan's 2008 superhero sequel, sequel to Batman Begins. The Dark Knight, of course, stars Christian Bale as Bruce Wayne / Batman. He's a few years into his career as the Dark Knight, the titular Dark Knight, and a new supervillain has emerged on the scene, Heath Ledger's Joker. And it's really about the battle between him for the soul of Gotham.
And obviously, as you mentioned, Heath Ledger, this is the film that got him the Oscar.
Posthumous Oscar, yeah.
Yeah, and is sort of the film that defined his career. And this is what we remember him for. Why is he so good in this?
The thing that really stood out to me watching it for the first time is that I had such a clear image of who the Joker was in my head, primarily because of Jack Nicholson and Tim Burton's Batman. Heath Ledger does something totally unexpected and new and shocking and groundbreaking and just completely hypnotic with that performance. Everything about it is just exciting. The way his voice kind of modulates as he's speaking, it goes from this kind of deep timbre to this kind of screeching, yelping, and the way he kind of licks his lips and everything to do with his scars by his face and his greasy, horrible green hair and his incredible costumes, which are flamboyant, but at the same time look practical. And the way that he operates, the way that he's kind of this urban terrorist, just everything that they did to realize that character, starting from the prologue, which of course debuted a few months before the actual film, just felt just thrilling to me. I don't know that any film since has done such a good job at reinventing a character like that, as iconic as that.
Not even Joker.
Exactly, yeah. Joker came close, though. I will admit, I like that film a lot.
Yeah.
But he had very big clown shoes to fill Ledger. What did you like about it, Matthew?
At the end of Batman Begins, we get Commissioner Gordon saying there's going to be escalation, and that's exactly what Nolan does with this film. This is one of the great sequels. I mean, we have to remind ourselves how hard it is to pull off a great sequel, and there's so few that actually can outdo the original. And this one, it's much bigger. It's like Nolan's Heat, really, with Pacino and De Niro. But I mean, even that's kind of doing it a disservice in a way, because it has become its own thing. It sort of transcended that. It really captured the moment. And it's just a great urban thriller. I mean, it sort of transcends the superhero label as well. This fantastic cat and mouse chase all over Gotham City. And it has a real sort of weight and gravitas to it as well.
It feels like it has real menace, doesn't it? Like, it's sort of the first time in the Batman films that you genuinely feel like there's real danger here, and this feels gritty and scary. It has amazing stunts. Nolan just does incredible stunts.
The opener, the zip line opener, just astonishing.
Yeah, and the truck flip, of course.
It's
just crazy to think that he did that practically. I mean, I'm sure everyone's seen there's a truck flip in the Fast and Furious 9 trailer, but that's quite clearly been done with CGI, and that's obviously how they would do it nowadays. But Nolan's the only person you could imagine actually getting a truck and flipping it over. He has these lovely, like, grace notes throughout the action as well, like the Batpod, the bike, kind of turning around on a dime by riding up a wall and flipping behind. Like, just so cool. I love the redesign of Bale's Batman's bat suit as well. It just looks so slick. I love the way everything feels so practical and it's all grounded in some kind of technology that sort of exists in the real world. Like, it really helped make a superhero story like this feel believable and grounded in our reality to me.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, it means the first superhero film to gross over $1 billion. So it feels like it kind of transcend, you know, its core superhero audience. I mean, it made so much more money than Batman Begins. It just really kind of captured the zeitgeist.
Yeah. Robert Pattinson has a lot of pressure on him now to create something as arresting as that was when it came out.
And just a word of praise for Hans Zimmer's score as well.
Yes.
Which is another soundtrack which gets heavy rotation on my iPhone. Great writer music for any writers out there. Everything about that score is just magnificent.
Okay, so that's The Dark Knight, which was 2008. So we'll move on from Gotham to some linguistics now.
There are days that define your story beyond your life. Like the day they arrived.
Signs of what might be called first contact. The objects measure at least...
I'm Colonel G.T. Weber from Army Intelligence.
Pack your bags.
You're at the top of everyone's list when it comes to translations.
Priority one. What do they want? Where are they from?
You'll be reporting to me, but you'll be working with him when you're in the show.
That's what they call in the UFO.
Okay, so that is Arrival, Denis Villeneuve's 2016 sci-fi that is about UFOs, but also not about UFOs. And that is coming in at number 4 in our chart. What is it about, Matthew?
Well, yeah, this is Denis Villeneuve's Arrival. It centers on linguist Louise, played by Amy Adams, and after a UFO visitation, she becomes the one who communicates with the aliens using their own special language. So it's kind of a linguistics lesson, as well as a sci-fi movie. And we learn a great deal about humanity through what the aliens can teach us. And it's kind of very much a film about what would you do with your time? What would you do if you knew what was going to happen in your future? And a lot of that relates to... parenting as well, because she's the mother of a daughter, so it has that kind of emotional hook. But I suppose it's one you don't want to say too much about for people who haven't seen it. It's one of those films where you discover things along with the main character, but there is like what they'd call in Doctor Who a timey-wimey twist towards the end.
Yes, a timey-wimey twist. When I saw this, it reminded me of The Abyss in the way that it sort of fuses that sort of threat of the other with the sort of reflection on the human race and how we behave and how we value each other. And as you say, what we would do with precious time if we were aware of everything. So I love that. I love when sci-fi marries those two things together. You must love it, Jordan, because it's right up your street.
Yeah, I absolutely adore this film. It's a real intellectual bit of sci-fi. There's not many of those that are given this kind of lavish a treatment. And the thing that really impressed me about it the first time around, A, just how smart it is in its approach to, as Matthew said, sort of linguistics and language, kind of a very practical approach to how we would actually communicate with an alien species. And then on the other hand, it is surprisingly emotional. It opens with a sequence, a loss, shall we say, set almost exclusively to Max Richter's On the Nature of Daylight, which is just a heartbreakingly beautiful bit of music and practically reduced me to tears in the first 5 minutes. It was like a sci-fi.
Yeah, it's a bit like exactly.
I remember from that moment just thinking, wow, we're in for something unexpected and brilliant here. And it didn't disappoint throughout the rest of the film.
And also,
film of the year in 2016.
It was our film of the year. And it's also really great to see, you know, this being spearheaded by a female scientist. You know, like, it's not just the guys that are going up there. She's actually one of the bravest people because of certain traumas in her life that have made her sort of fearless in a way. But I just think Amy Adams is so good in this sort of thing. And she's just brilliant in this. You really believe her entirely and trust that she could be the one that actually creates this bridge between humans and whatever these aliens are and whatever that is that they want. And those pods are just really sort of foreboding, aren't they? These just huge egg things appearing all over the world. And the door opens, you know, every 12 hours for a few minutes up into this weird black space, which is a bit sort of reminiscent of, as we discussed last week, Under the Skin, that sort of weird black space that's endless and also contained. The design in this film is excellent. And, you know, it's Denis Villeneuve, who's doing a little film called Dune that's supposed to be coming out at the end of the year.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you see what he can do with this and then Blade Runner, you know, he's just really good at this sort of world building and the design and the look of stuff, don't you think?
Yeah, he's become like a modern Kubrick, hasn't he? He's really kind of earned his spurs in sci-fi. Yeah. So yeah, Dune shaping up really well on the evidence of these two films.
It's one of the few really big budget sci-fi movies where the aliens actually look alien and they're not just humanoids in, you know, makeup or whatever. They really went all out trying to depict an alien species in this film. And yeah. I love that they just designed the language of the aliens down to the minutiae and that it actually works, this kind of circular language, which seems to be written in smoke or something like that. Like, everything about it seems so well considered and exciting.
Yeah. It also feels like a film that Nolan might have watched and gone, oh, God, that's good. I wish I'd thought of it.
Because it is, yeah, it's very simple, and it does share Nolan's interest in chronology and telling interesting stories which aren't necessarily linear. Like, I thought that aspect was fascinating and really effective for me as well.
Yeah. Okay, so that is Arrival. Shall we see what's rolling in at number three?
Oh, what a day! What a lovely day!
Want to get through this?
Let's go!
Okay, so that is Mad Max Fury Road. Yeah! What a lovely day! From 2015. Obviously, it is connected to the Mad Max series, but how, Jordan?
It's set a number of years later, but in many ways, it's almost like a soft reboot. So Tom Hardy stars as Max, the titular Mad Max. When we meet him, he's driving around the wasteland and he's sort of captured by the forces of Immortan Joe, who's this sort of desert wasteland. And Max gets caught up effectively in the story of Imperator Furiosa, who's played by Charlize Theron. She's a driver for Immortan Joe, and she has decided to escape his clutches and break out Immortan Joe's wives. And then from there, it's effectively a two-hour chase movie where Max, Furiosa, and the wives are on the run from Immortan Joe's forces and the many other weird people who pursue them across the desert. And the story is very simplistic here. There's some good stuff about liberation and oppression with regards to the women that have been effectively enslaved and used as birthing machines for a number of years. But the real standout here is George Miller's action. His car chases, the way he shoots them, it's just unparalleled. No one has shot car chases like this before. No one shoots action like George Miller. It's so visceral, but it's also so coherent. That's the most incredible thing about it. For so many years before this, we had the quick cutting kind of obsession where you would mask the fact that maybe the action wouldn't be that exciting if it was shot in a wide shot. But with George Miller, his action is never unclear. You always have a very clear sense of what's going on, and yet it still manages to be unbelievable. And you can't believe that a lot of this was actually shot in a desert with real cars. It just looks so unbelievably dangerous. Like, I don't know how like hundreds of people didn't die making this film, but they did. They shot it very safely, and the results are inarguably, in my opinion, the best car chases that have ever been put on film.
Take that, Fast and the Furious.
I'm sorry, Vin.
What about the bank vault in Fast and Furious 5?
Come on.
It's wicked, but I'm going to have to give this one to Fury Road.
Yeah, and I mean, cinematography is beautiful. The location is beautiful. You know, Charlize is so badass. I mean, she's so incredible. And, you know, arguably, it's her film, really, rather than...
I'd say inarguably,
much more than Tom Hardy.
Hardy's just the sort of... He's MacGuffin along for the ride. Almost, yeah. To get to this story. Yeah, as you say, it's exhilarating to watch. You feel like you're at the wheel of those juggernauts going across the desert in all of that dust. Yeah, and there's that incredible scene when you've got, is it the Doof playing the...
The Doof Warrior.
The Doof Warrior, playing the fire-spurting guitar on the back of this huge speaker truck. Which is just mental. And people on like sticks bouncing. I mean, it's nuts, and it totally works.
It's like Cirque du Soleil, isn't it?
On
on a car carrier.
But I think it's really, you know, testament to the fact of somebody who has such a vision of what they wanted to put on film and taking it right to the end. And, you know, this didn't have a very happy filming. People were not getting on and falling out. There was reshoots and all sorts of things. But that his singular vision ensured that the clarity of what went on screen and that sort of clarity that Jordan's talking about made it such a great watch.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's incredible. It was 30 years since the previous Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, that he returned to this franchise and kind of took it to the next level.
After having made Happy Feet and Babe in the intervening years.
That's crazy.
Yeah, who would have thought?
I think, you know, Babe could have benefited from driving a sort of big diesel truck across the fields.
The Duke Warrior.
Yeah, that'll do, pig.
How's the black and white version?
The black and chrome version.
Black and chrome. of course it is.
It was billed as George Miller's original vision for the film. And there's a certain amount to recommend about it because it's still, you know, incredibly striking visually. But so much of what makes that film great for me is that color palette and those like the orange desert hues and those remarkable blues. It just feels odd to be missing that as you're watching it. So even though it's still the same great film, for me, it's missing a little something when you're watching it in black and chrome.
Yeah, I have it on my DVD shelf, my Blu-ray shelf, and I've yet to watch it. I just always reach for the colour one because
I think I would.
Yeah, it's gorgeous to look at. So that is Mad Max Fury Road, which is at number 3. We're getting closer now. Shall we find out what's nearly the best of the best and the penultimate corker? It's this one.
This is not an easy job. I have to take everything and play as it lays. Sometimes people need a little help. Sometimes people need to be forgiven. And that is a very tricky thing on my part, making that call. But you can forgive someone? Well, that's the tough part.
Okay, so that is Magnolia from 1999. I mean, there's a lot going on in this, so which one of you wants to try to pass this down into what this is?
Shall I try?
Go for it, Matthew.
Give it a go, Matthew.
So this is Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia. I won't attempt to summarise, but it is one of his kind of tapestry movies, similar to Boogie Nights, with a vast array of characters who relate in different ways. There's a kind of a theme of chance and coincidence, which is highlighted from the start. And that kind of carries on through the movie. But mostly it is about following these different characters who are all kind of not having great days in most cases. For most people, the standout is Tom Cruise's, I don't know, what would you call him? A kind of...
A motivational speaker?
Yeah, he's a
pickup artist.
Sleazebag.
Yeah.
Sleazebag, you know, kind of, worshipper of the penis.
And he's kind of got dad issues.
He certainly does. And he's got like a David Beckham haircut at that stage, hasn't he? Very of the era, the man ponytail going on, half ponytail scenario. And a leather waistcoat. When I think about Magnolia, I do think about Tom Cruise. I mean, there's some amazing actors in this. There's Philip Seymour Hoffman, there's Julianne Moore.
John C. Reilly.
I mean, numerous great
Laura
actors.
Walters.
But when you think about it, you do think about Cruise just going full douchebag.
Respecting the and taming the...
Exactly. Yeah, he's an odious sort of invention, but it lends itself to that sort of Tom Cruise intensity that he does bring to a role.
Absolutely,
and his need to have that cast iron belief in what he's preaching, because otherwise if he really thought about it and thought about his life and everything else, then he might just fall to pieces. And it's also got like weird elements in it, like a raining of frogs. Yes, this was obviously award-winning as well, an award nominated throughout all of the different ceremonies. But why do you think our writers love this so much?
It's a great actor showcase. I mean, we said about all the performances. There's no weak link in the acting. Anderson is just a master of tying it all together. He's got so many different threads, so many plates. He's spinning and he keeps it going over the course of 3 hours. I mean, that's kind of quite remarkable. There's no kind of dip in the intensity or your interest in these characters when they all feel fleshed out. It's got some great lines, great set pieces. Tim kind of taking it up a notch, even from something like Boogie Nights, which was, you know, really showed off his visual qualities.
But he has made some, you know, films that our team has absolutely adored since then. But topped those.
I have to admit, Magnolia is not low down on my list of Paul Thomas Anderson films, but it's certainly not my number one. There are at least a couple I would put ahead of this. But our writers love it for very good reasons.
This is showcasing what Paul Thomas Anderson does so well. And his attention to detail, his fact that he's not going to hurry a narrative in any way. If it takes 3 hours to fulfill that narrative, that's what's going to happen. Yeah, he's just painstaking cinematic excavation of people and their characters and their feelings and their failings.
Mm. Yeah. To me, this was the film that sort of crowned him as the successor to Robert Altman in terms of those, you know, huge ensemble dramas with inflated runtimes. You don't have many filmmakers attempting to make these, and for good reason, partly because of economics. I doubt it makes a lot of economic sense to make films like these, but also because they're just so hard to do, because you're effectively making 12 films in one about all these different characters and cross-cutting and these stories intersecting. That's really not an easy thing to do. And for it to actually pay off by the end, that takes real skill. And it's something that PTA achieves seemingly effortlessly.
And continues to do so in the films that have come since as well.
His films since have been a bit more focused. They're generally character studies of a singular character rather than a dozen. But you can see the seeds of, you know, There Will Be Blood and Phantom Thread in something like Olia, definitely.
Yeah, I'd love to see him do something on this scale again. I mean, much as I love There Will Be Blood and Phantom Thread, but seeing do this kind of canvas. But yeah, like you say, I mean, it must be hard economically to pull something like this together these days.
Okay, so that is Magnolia from 1999. So here we are. We're at the greatest movie of Total Film's lifetime. Are you ready to know what that is? It's this one.
What is the Matrix?
The Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
They're watching you, Neo.
Human beings are a disease. You are a cancer of this planet. And we are the cure.
Get me the hell out of here!
Welcome to the real world.
Yes, of course, that is The Matrix, also from 1999. That was a very good year, wasn't it? I mean, in case you've been living under a rock, what is The Matrix about?
Well, what is The Matrix? It's the central question of the film. What the hell is The Matrix? Yeah, so this is Lana and Lily Wachowski's cyberpunk sci-fi film. Keanu Reeves stars as Neo, or The One. In his old life, he's known as Thomas Anderson, but his eyes are open to the existence of The Matrix, which is a computer simulation which everyone in the world is hooked up to, and they believe they're living a normal life, but in fact, they're just fuel for machines that have taken over the world, which has been left in a post-apocalyptic scorched sky state ever since a devastating war. But the thing that really impresses about this film, even to this day, beyond its imagination, is just how remarkable and revolutionary the action felt at the time. The way that reality intersects with the impossible is still remarkable to me. Simple stuff like wire work, you seem to get more bang for your buck in this than any other film I can think of. It's still amazing to me when you see Neo bend backwards and dodge bullets. Like, that feels like proper movie magic. And back in 1999, it was mind-blowing. I mean, this was the year that Star Wars was supposed to revolutionize cinema, and The Matrix just totally stole its thunder. Like, that was the film that everyone was talking about.
And it also, you know, it showed us Keanu Reeves as this whole new action hero in the dark glasses and the black coat and the all black suit. We thought he was cool before, but we were like, whoa, he is like off the chart cool now. Keanu.
I remember amazing. A friend at school had the Nokia kind of, not the flip phone, with the kind of cover that shoots out that Neo has at the start of this film.
Wow.
And he was just like the coolest guy in school because of that. I was intensely jealous.
Amazing.
It was such an influential film as well. I mean, for how many years were people just imitating those black leather trench coats and the style of action this film. I mean, I think like the Underworld franchise, for example, only exists because of those black leather trench coats in The Matrix. And even though it was nothing particularly new, especially if you were into anime in the 90s, like the Wachowskis, you know, were quite openly reverent and drawing from anime. It was something new for Hollywood and live action filmmaking at the time. So it did feel fresh and invigorating.
Yeah. You know, it spawned other films and now it's getting a new life again. So it feels like it actually was a film that actually did have plenty more places to go as well because of this concept that anybody could understand and anybody could dream about and think, God, what if? What if? Like, that's crazy. Would you have got Avatar if you hadn't have had The Matrix and that concept and the idea of the technology and what you could do with it as well? It sort of birthed, it seemed, like this new frontier of effects as well as concepts.
Yeah, it totally crossed over into the mainstream as well. Like, the idea that we could be living in The Matrix is just such a weird mainstream idea at this point. You know, whenever I get deja vu, I'm like, ooh, a glitch in The Matrix. Oh my God, this is proof.
Yeah, it's happening. And you know, it's spawned phrases that people still say, take the red pill, take the blue pill. Yeah, so it's just become that thing that is part of popular culture and part of everyone's conscience. Even if you haven't seen it, you probably have a complete idea of The Matrix and what it looks like and what its sort of feel is and what it's about. And you may never have to actually see a single frame of it because it's so pervasive in our culture.
It felt like it came out of nowhere as well. I mean, you had the Wachowskis had Bound, but that was kind of a fairly sort of cult indie film. And Keanu's fortunes were kind of up and down. He'd done Johnny Mnemonic, which was another kind of noir sci-fi, which didn't really take off. But I don't think anyone expected it to break out as much as it did. Yeah, it just took everybody by storm.
And took Keanu to total like global stardom. I mean, and John Wick again, and he'll be coming back for the new Matrix, which is super exciting.
It's funny to think that we almost had Will Smith and Sean Connery as Neo and Morpheus in this film. It would have been a very different Matrix, I think.
Yeah. I could kind of see Will Smith, but Sean Connery. Can you even imagine it?
Could you imagine him doing
to the Matrix?
Yeah.
I don't think he'd have been a match for Agent Smith.
No, you just wouldn't have felt that he was a contender, would you?
And I love Carrie Ann Moss in this film as well. Trinity's just one of the great sci-fi action heroines to me. She's just so cool and so capable. That opening sequence where she does the sort of crane kick where the camera rotates around her in bullet time. Just an indelible cinematic image, just totally iconic.
Yeah.
And it was parodied to death, wasn't it?
Oh, God,
like Scary Movie and Shrek and anything that came after that. It, as if they were doing it for the first time.
And it's the sort of thing that you do in your dreams. I certainly have had dreams where I've hovered there because it's so
cool.
Who
were you thinking?
Well, I had a cheese plate, what can I say? But I would love to be Trinity. I think every girl would love to be Trinity.
No one did bullet time as well afterwards either. Again, going back to things that we were talking about previously on this podcast, it was the perfect marriage of a visual effects technique and storytelling. Like, it felt like they weren't just throwing pixels at the screen. Like, what they were doing, those techniques that they developed, were totally justified for the story they were telling and absolutely enhanced it. And that's really what you want from visual effects. You want visual effects to enhance your storytelling.
Yeah, you don't want them stealing focus, and it doesn't at all. It's totally integral.
And of course, there were two sequels so far, Reloaded and Revolutions. I quite like Reloaded. I don't like Revolutions, but I feel that their existence doesn't draw from the quality of this film at all. It pretty much stands alone. It was made without the idea of the sequels in mind. I think that's telling. It ends in a really cool place and doesn't feel like you're left hanging. But as you mentioned, Jane, earlier in this, the fact that there's just possibilities, you can imagine another person waking up and another incredible story being told on the other side of this world. That was just thrilling to me.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, I think if it was made now, it would have already been conceived as a trilogy or an even larger franchise. And so that's the sort of loveliness of this, that the time in which it was released means that it was that almost naivety with it. They just put this film out into the world with no real expectation of it, and it became this huge cultural touchstone to everybody. And then became sort of the trilogy, and then now what's going on with the further franchise.
Even bigger than a trilogy. I mean, before, you know, Marvel popularized cinematic universes, they basically tried to build their own universe with The Matrix. They, of course, had The Animatrix, the spin-off. They had a video game, which directly tied into the sequels narratively, you know, starred Jada Pinkett Smith's character. It was really ambitious stuff. And it felt like they sort of stretched themselves a little bit too thin on the sequels. They just took on too much. But I can't fault their ambition. And at the time, the idea of all this stuff, all this storytelling in that world, there was just nothing more exciting to me.
And obviously, as you said, hugely influential. I mean, I can remember watching things like even Swordfish. Do you remember Swordfish?
Yeah.
And it had like this centrifugal kind of camera
explosion, right?
Tweakery that you're just like, oh, did you see The Matrix then? it's just left such a sort of huge cultural footprint. It's no surprise.
Even in the Harvester ad. Do you remember that Harvester ad where you got they're like chicken nuggets in the air suspended? And even kind of filtered down to that level.
That's what the chickens would have wanted. But, you know, it's no surprise, though, that this has become our number one, that our writers all love it with such passion that it's our number one film of our lifetime. So well done to everyone involved with The Matrix.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
It's time now to answer a reader's question before we go. So this week's one is, what movie has the best food scenes, ones that make you want to eat what's on screen?
Well, for me, it's quite a recent one, actually. I remember going to see Crazy Rich Asians and just feeling absolutely ravenous after watching that film, just because there's so much delicious-looking food in it. Mm. And The Farewell, too, also has basically the entirety of that film is set around a dinner table. Mm. Oh, they're basically moving from dinner table to dinner table. And it's all like delicious looking home cooked food. And it's all about the love of like this grandma for her family. And you can just tell that so much love's gone into that food. And I was just licking my lips all the way through.
Okay. Chopsticks at the ready for Jordan. What about you, Matthew?
The Harry Potter films, the Great Hall in Hogwarts, the kind of those school dinners. I mean, they're just the school dinners of your dreams. I mean, I don't know what it was like for you guys, but mine were just despicable.
I enjoyed my school dinners. I'm a weirdo. I loved school dinners.
You like a plain meal, though, don't you?
I do love a plain meal. So I clearly have sort of institutionalized tastes.
Anything from a plastic tray is good by you.
Anything that's been reheated and is under like a cling film that's slightly sweaty, I'm into it. I don't know what that says. Was there anything particular at Hogwarts you wanted to eat?
I think the desserts. I mean, just when you, it's like a whole dessert, a trolley worth on one plate. And the roasts as well. I mean, it's just so, I mean, it's kind of obscene, really, the amount they have. I mean, I assume it's just kind of created by magic, so they're not kind of draining natural resources or taking it away from anyone else. It does look just incredible.
I was very, very glad when I got a mug of butterbeer at the...
Oh, well, the Harry Potter tour.
Yeah. That was a dream come true.
Butterbeer ice cream, that's nice as well.
Yeah. My thing is probably a recent one. I mean, there's loads of films, aren't there? I mean, whenever you see, you know, I think of Big Night and the cooking of Italian food.
Like
Water for Chocolate when people are making food there and it's just delicious. But the one recently that really got me was I saw Birds of Prey in a morning screening. And when she went and got that dirty, cheesy bacon, delicious thing.
That sandwich.
Like as soon as you've got it in your wrapper, it is making it translucent with the grease. I was like, I desperately want that. I need that in my life. And I had
like
to go
a character in the film.
Yeah, I had to go to McDonald's and get myself like one of those breakfast sandwiches, which was a very poor substitute. I really wanted Harley Quinn's greasy sandwich. Yeah. So that's mine.
I also felt like Jon Favreau's chef should have come with like some warning to like make sure you eat before you watch this film.
Because
it's just obscene the amount of like delicious looking barbecue in that film.
Yeah.
I just couldn't handle it. Like I think I watched it at home. I just had to stop halfway through and like have a snack or something.
They should probably put a warning on films, shouldn't they? Like, you know, violence and everything, but also you're going to need like a bucket of chicken for this or, you know, some cannelloni or whatever it is. You need to have this to hand. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so on that note, let's remind people that there's 10% off total film subscriptions with the code INSIDETF when you go to check out at www.myfavoritemagazines.co.uk, and it is well worth it. There are some superb offers on at the moment. You can get some great movie content for a fraction of the price. That's all I'm saying. So go and get it. And also, we'd just love it, wouldn't we? We'd be forever grateful. We'd just be
forever in your debt.
We would light a little candle at our altar to the subscriptions.
Yeah, best friend.
Yeah, we love them. So on that note, I think we should probably say goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye, boys, and bye everyone at home.